Thank you for listening to the article podcast from the UBS Art Advisory Team, which guides individuals and families towards best practices and principles to build, maintain, and plan for exceptional, lasting collections. My name is Rachel Peart, UBS Art Advisory Specialist for the U.S. and co-host of this series, in which UBS will share insights from practitioners in the art and collectibles world. While my guests and I sometimes discuss service and capabilities that they and their organizations provide, please note that UBS has no formal affiliation with any of our guests or their organizations, and in no way is UBS promoting or endorsing our guests or their organizations. And now, on to the episode. Today, we're going behind the curtain to explore important elements of an auction that are refined long before the auctioneer takes to the podium, specifically in how estimates are formed. We're speaking with Emily Kaplan, Senior Vice President and Senior Specialist of Postwar and Contemporary Art at Christie's. For the past 5 years, she has been the co-head of the 20th Century Evening Sale. Her focus is in post-war period, specializing in abstract expressionism, pop, and minimalism, among others. In May 2021, she pioneered the first 20th Century Evening Sale to outstanding results, totaling $481 million. Emily has worked in the auction world for 15 years. Prior to running the evening sale, Emily spent much of her career focused on day and mid-season sales of post-war and contemporary art. Emily will share her highlights for the upcoming spring season, including the formative offering of works by the late philanthropist and collector Agnes Gund. But first, we're going inside a very important component of auction, estimates. How are they set, shaped, and the psychological components behind them? And do their values frame a work before bidding even begins? Emily, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I know this is very timely. It's a very busy time of year.
Yes.
As the spring season has started in London with evening sales as we speak taking place.
Yes.
So there are many aspects of an auction I'd love to discuss with you. But today I'd really like to dive into estimates. I want to first talk about the definition of an estimate, typically comprised of a low and a high value range, a monetary range, which is reflecting the expectations generally of where you think a work is going to be at auction. So I want to start with what point in the consignment process does an estimate begin to take shape and who is typically involved in that decision?
It's a great question, and I would say the estimate is often the most important piece of a consignment conversation as we are pitching for business and speaking to sellers. It is something that is less an indication of value and more a part of the overall strategy of how we are presenting a work of art. Especially at the evening sale level, we like to take a lot of care in how we are positioning an estimate. We want to set up the work for the best chance of success, particularly in an evening sale where the audience is so broad and it is such a public theatrical event. We really want to maximize bidding on every lot. We believe in often setting the estimate to entice every possible bidder. That can, though, take different shapes based on the work itself. In some instances, we suggest a very conservative estimate strategy or an appropriately conservative estimate strategy, taking into account many factors, which I can get into, but that often is successful in drawing as many collectors into the work of art and engaging them off the bat. So when collectors are flipping through the catalogs and looking through the online offerings, if an estimate seems appealing, they automatically gravitate towards it, and you know, they circle it in their book or they make a note of it and they keep coming back to it. If the estimate is too high from the beginning, they may write it off from the beginning and never look at it again. They may not realize that the reserve could come down or there will be, you know, opportunities slightly below the estimate. So what a lower estimate does is really attracts every possible collector at the initial moment when they first see it. There's not a question of, oh, this is too expensive. It brings everybody in. And each additional bidder adds so much value at the end of the day that often a conservative estimate strategy actually ends up making a higher price in the final sale total. So that can be a very important strategy to really entice as many collectors in as possible. But it is often the case that a seller does not want to part with a work at a lower estimate, right? We have to be able to sell the work within the estimate range. So we don't want to set the estimate too low if a seller has higher aspirations for it. And so it's often part of the initial consignment conversation where a collector wants a higher number and we discuss internally. Sometimes it's saying, yes, we believe that that's the right level. We will go there. And that is a way that we would be happy to position it to prospective buyers. Sometimes it's a bit of a negotiation, and we always want to give our best recommendation and really set up the work for success, but it happens right at the beginning of the process, and it's really a collaboration between us and the sellers.
Mm-hmm. You really touched on a number of things I want to get into, but let's actually back out for a second, talk about the mysterious world of reserves mm-hmm. for a moment. Mm-hmm. So we're sitting from a seller's perspective or a potential seller.
Yes.
And they really may have expectations, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. and this sort of set idea of the value that they will not sell less than, which
yes.
in effect is what a reserve acts as. Now, can you tell a little bit more for people who may not be as familiar how a reserve works?
Mm-hmm. The reserve is the minimum number that we are contractually allowed to sell a work for, and it is agreed between Christie's and the seller confidentially. So that is not a number that we put out there to the world. It is something that we agree and are then go out and try to get as many people bidding as possible. We cannot set the reserve higher than the low estimate. So often collectors say, oh, you know, I want an estimate of $100,000 to $150,000, but the reserve needs to be at $200,000. That's not possible. That in that kind of situation, the highest the reserve could be is $100,000. It can be anywhere lower than that, from the low estimate, which is common to have the reserve at the low estimate, all the way to no reserve. No reserve, it happens from time to time, typically on lower value lots, but there are examples at a higher level. My first season at Christie's, we did a bold move when we were offering the magnificent Hockney portrait of an artist with the pool with two figures. And at the last, 24 hours, we decided that it was going to be a no reserve lot.
Wow.
This is the most famous painting by Hockney presented to market at no reserve. It's an unprecedented move, and it was very, very bold. It was successful in the end, and it set the artist record at the time, which is still the artist record today, of $90 million. So it can be, again, like an estimate, sort of a strategy to get interest. If you say, oh, there's no reserve on this lot, then that can pull in a lot of people because you dare to dream that you could own the work and bid anything you want, and it could be yours. In a no reserve situation, we actually are obliged to message out to collectors, to bidders and buyers, that it is no reserve. So that's the only situation in which we actually communicate a reserve, is when there is no reserve. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, the dynamics of an auction room when there's no reserve is quite different. Rather than bidding always going up, it actually can go down. So if, you open the bidding at $1 million and you don't get a bid, you can go down from there. So it changes the dynamics quite a bit. But a no reserve situation, especially in an evening sale context, is quite rare. More frequently, the reserves are set at the low estimate or a percentage of that. So 90%, 80%, 70%, that sort of a typical range of where reserves can be set. Those are sometimes set off the bat when we're discussing a consignment, but more frequently they're set right before the auction within the last 24 to 48 hours. Once we have a sense of interest and we say, you know, we recommend a bit of discretion on the reserve to really get the room going. If the auctioneer opens it at 70% of the low estimate, people start throwing their hands up. So it has a similar effect as a lower conservative estimate of drawing in more bidders. And then sometimes if you've bid once, you actually may bid more than once because you're sort of engaged and the auctioneer pulls you in, and that's part of the drama.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that we're touching upon the really important aspect of the psychological component mm-hmm. of both the bidders in the room, but then you're also navigating as a seller the kind of risk that they might be taking, but also understanding what that upside may look like. Mm-hmm. And that obviously it very much sounds like a conversation all the way until, is it fair to say, the work actually comes up to the auction block before the lot opens.
Yes.
That reserve is being discussed.
Yes.
So that it's really getting its best chance. That's fascinating. And I think it touches upon, I think there's sort of a misconception. If I have a work of art that I'm wanting to sell, I think that the highest estimate is going to be best.
Mm.
And really, from what you've said, that actually can be detrimental to a work.
Yes, yes, absolutely. You're right. I think in most situations, a more conservative auction estimate is the stronger strategy. To the psychological element that you're mentioning, when collectors, of course, I mentioned that when collectors see a work first with an attractive estimate, it brings them in from the very first moment. It gets it on their mind and it gets it in their head. You start measuring your walls. You start thinking about where it's going to go. You start thinking about shipping costs. So you already get excited and engaged. Then because that pulls in more potential bidders in the auction room, when you're seeing 5 hands go up, 10 hands go up, you're fighting, you're battling against people, it gives a bit of competitive spirit. And people bid beyond what they thought that they were going to because they get carried away or they get sort of validated by the competition. You know, the estimate was 1 to 2 million, but we're at $3 million and there's still 3 bidders. This must be the value. You know, this is validation that this is a higher value than the estimate would suggest. So it is very psychological, and that is a very powerful tool. It's not always the right strategy. There are exceptions. We have certainly had some successful examples in the last few years where we present works to the market, particularly that have really no comparables or are the best in class at a unprecedented estimate level. So one recent example, not so recent, I suppose it was about 4 years ago, we encountered this incredible work of art by Lee Bontecue, one of my favorite artists. Her works, particularly the larger scale, more complex wall relief works, are very rare to market. Many of them are in museums. And we went after a superb example that had been in a private collection for decades, and the current auction record when we were pitching for this work was about $1.8 million. That's all in. So, of course, when you're buying at auction, there's the hammer price, and then there's the buyer's premium fees, and that full all-in price with the fees is what is the reported price. So around 1.7 or 1.8 all-in. The seller said, I'm not going to sell it for less than $2 million net to me. So we say, okay, should we go to $2 to $3 million? This is unprecedented. That would at least mean, you know, $2.4 million all-in. That's quite a bit higher. Should we? And ultimately we said, listen, there's nothing of this quality on the market. It has been years since the last one even approaching this quality has come up. It's worth the risk. Let's go for it. So we presented at a $2 to $3 million estimate, so very much pushed the boat out with the estimate, established that it was going to set the new record if it sold. There were so many bidders. It ended up selling over $9 million in the end. Of course, establishing quite a new auction record by
Absolutely.
Many multiples. And it was a validation of the strategy that sometimes when you put an estimate at a record level, it actually gets people's attention. It makes them say, oh, this is the best quality work that has come up. I should pay attention to this. You're telling the market what it should be worth, and that is often an effective strategy as well.
That's a great example. And that really touches base on the factors that go into the consideration of an estimate, because I do want to talk about, obviously, there are so many prolific artists there, but obviously not all artworks are created equal. And so what kind of even on a more fundamental level, and then, you know, we've talked a little bit about market demands and kind of exceptional works that, you know, don't have any comparables. But when you're really looking at the fundamental levels, what are the factors that you're thinking about? You know, even if we're talking about someone like Picasso or Monet, mm-hmm. you know, what are you thinking about when you're starting off with building those estimates?
Mm-hmm. There are many factors that we look at when we are estimating works of art. There, of course, are previous auction comparables. We always look at what works have sold for recently. Sometimes that's very straightforward. Of course, in the market of multiples and editions, it's very straightforward. There, you set the estimate where, you know, the estimates have been set previously, where they have been selling previously. When they're not unique objects, it's quite straightforward where you would put an estimate. When you're talking about unique objects, you want to look at works that have sold recently, both at auction, and we have, of course, have quite a database of knowledge of private sales and private transactions, what our clients are buying and selling, even outside of the auctions. And we take that into consideration. But each object is individual and unique, so we really have to look at it on its own merits. And factors that go into that include the condition of the work. It's very important. We love to stand in front of a painting before we give it, you know, we confirm our value, because often a picture does not show. There might be cracking. There might be some restoration. There might be a lining. There might be a varnish. These are all factors that can inform our estimate. Not always, but they can. It depends on the artist, what's common, what's not. But that's a very important piece of it. The standing in front of it also will give us a sense of the surface, the texture, the colors, the scale. That's hard to convey often in a picture. Often the composition is just more beautiful than any other work that has been up. So it could have, you could tick all the boxes of the other works that have sold, but it's just a more beautiful composition or just a more interesting work of art. And that can impact the value. That can change the value from other comparables. It can have exceptional provenance. Provenance is a very important piece of the puzzle, something that collectors really look at. That can be whether it's just fresh to market, been in a collection for a very long time. It can be that a very notable collector once owned it. We'll talk about the Gund works coming up. That's certainly an important element there. But the market is very sensitive to that. If a work has come up to auction in the past year, 5 years, it's a little bit less exciting sometimes than if a work has been hidden away in a private collection for decades. A discovery is always exciting to the market. Other factors can include museum shows, institutional support. Often we go after works where the artists are getting a retrospective, or there's a new gallery representation, or something happening in the market that's exciting. That can certainly add value. It turns new collectors on to artists that they may have never thought about. All of these factors really play into it. The rarity, you know, we love to look at, particularly at the evening sale level, how many works of this type are in museums. So you could, you know, of the 20 works of this series, 15 are in museums. So there are actually only five that are in private hands and could be purchased. So these are all elements we look at that inform our estimate setting. It's more an art than a science. We need to be very thoughtful and think about how much each lever really will impact the value.
And it sounds like every season and every sale, you're constantly taking in all these new data points of what's happened from past records and also what's happening, as you know, in the private sector with where demand is as well. Well, I have one other question, then I want to shift into our spring season. But I feel like a topic that could have its complete own conversation is guarantees. But I do want to tie that into the conversation just briefly, because I do think it's something that comes up quite a bit when we talk about evening sales and goes back into that conversation about threading the needle between the balance, the reserve with your seller, and mm-hmm. also that psychology with making sure that you have that competitive bidding that's building in the room. And so if you can just, you know, even in short, just tell us a little bit more about like how guarantees work and how that sort of factors in.
It's a very important piece of the estimating puzzle, increasingly more so, I would say, with every year. When I first started in this market 15 years ago, guarantees were pretty infrequent. And now it's a huge part of our process, particularly even at the early stages of a consignment. Sometimes when a collector tells us that they want a higher estimate than we initially would have put on it, what we can do and often seek to do is get secure a third party who is willing to put a guarantee on the work. So say our estimate is $2 to $3 million, but they really want an estimate of $3 to $5 million. Okay, that might be higher than we are willing to risk in an auction setting, but let's see. We know there's a few collectors who are looking for a painting just like this. We will go to them and see if they're willing to put a guarantee on it at $3 million. If we're able to secure one, we can put the estimate at that level and have a bid to start us off. There's a guaranteed bid. We know it's selling at $3 million, say. While that can push an estimate to a more aggressive place, you also have the market validation of someone saying, listen, I'm willing to buy this at that level. So it actually does help motivate other collectors to look seriously at the work, even if they may have thought that the estimate was a little bit pushed, because they say, well, somebody else thinks it's at that level, that value is correct. Someone else will buy it. It's not as if it won't sell, and I can try and make an offer that will be lower than this estimate. So it can really galvanize interest because there is that sort of external validation of a guarantee. That's something that we use both at the business getting early consignment getting stage, but also as we get closer to the sale. Once we've built the sale, guarantees have become a very big part of the way that we're interacting with our clients and selling to our clients. There are certainly both trade and private collectors who like to do guarantees. They say, listen, I know I'm going to be interested and bid on this anyway, and are happy to place that first bid. And the way a guarantee works is that they then participate in the upside if the work sells beyond their guarantee. So it's sort of a win-win situation for them. It's not always what a seller wants. Sometimes that a guarantee is not desirable, as they have to give up some of their upside. But it is certainly an interesting lever that we now have, and something that can certainly incentivize certain sellers to sell because they know they have the guarantee and are guaranteed to get their price at a minimum.
And from an outsider, if you're either a potential maybe bidder or you're just an observer, guarantees, we talked about like no reserves being acknowledged. Mm-hmm. If a work is guaranteed, is there also a public acknowledgement before a sale, knowing that a work has safety, or is that something that's confidential?
Great question. That is broadcasted. When our catalogs go public, both online and in a printed version, we include symbols. And there is a specific symbol that shows that a work has been guaranteed either by Christie's or by a third party. So that and those continually get updated on our website, and they are announced at the beginning of the auction. So everyone knows, and that's something that, you know, collectors come to us and they ask us if works are guaranteed. We tell them that is something that we can say a work is guaranteed. The exact level is not broadcasted, but the fact that it is guaranteed is we do let collectors know that.
Yeah, arming bidders and clients with that data
yes.
as they go into the sale.
Yeah.
Well, this is actually a great point, I think, to turn to the upcoming season. As we said, we started in London. It's already kicked off. And now we're getting ready for the May evening sales in New York. And there has been the announcement of the very important works that are coming to the auction block from the late philanthropist and collector Agnes Gunn. Can you tell us a little bit more about these significant works?
Yes. Christie's is so excited and just honored to be able to offer three works from the collection of Agnes Gund. She was a legend in the art world. That doesn't even do justice to what she was. She, of course, was an incredible noted collector, a patron of artists, the president of MoMA for over a decade, just a wonderful person and incredible collector. She was also a warrior for social justice. She did so many wonderful initiatives that changed the world throughout her life. So to be able to offer her Aggie Gunn's collection is a true privilege, and I think myself and all of my colleagues at Christie's are truly humbled to be able to offer works from her collection and really show her a small piece of her collecting vision and her incredible legacy. These three works, of course, she collected thousands of works, and most of them have been donated both to MoMA and other institutions. So three works may not sound like a lot, but they are three seminal works that stayed in her collection until the end. The top lot of the group is the Rothko number 15. This is a large scale, over 90 inch painting from 1964. Aggie purchased the work directly from Rothko just a few years later in 1967, which is remarkable. We really don't see that a lot. In fact, there's only three other works that we know of that were purchased directly from Rothko and are still in those collections. So that is very rare. I spoke about how important provenance is and freshness to market. And this hits all of those notes and is very rare, very, very special. It's said that in 1967, Aggie went to Rothko's studio with Emily Tremaine, who was a very well-known collector, and they picked out this Rothko. Rothko suggested that she purchase this work, and she thought about it, and she realized she loved it, and it was only loaned out one time for an exhibition and otherwise was in her apartment for her whole life. She was photographed in front of it many times. It was beloved to her. It is truly a masterpiece when you see it in person. The scale, the coloration envelop you. It was painted during a period where Rothko was exploring a more somber palette. He, a few years earlier, had been commissioned for the Seagram's murals. Just the same year this was painted, he was commissioned for the works in the Rothko Chapel in Houston by the Menil family. So he started to explore the depths of these darker colors and how there is a spirituality in the way that darker hues play off of each other. The background of this painting is beautiful. It's sort of indescribable. It's a purple-blue indigo color. And on top of it, there is a almost translucent, hazy green, punctuated by a bold red stripe in the bottom third. It is a spiritual experience to stand in front of it. We are going to try to give viewers that experience. We're curating some very special viewing experiences for our clients that will really show how the work transforms when you stand in front of it in different lighting. It's a remarkable work, and we are excited for collectors to get to experience it in person. The second work in the collection is a 1961 painting by Cy Twombly. This was from his period in where he was living and painting in Rome. He was very inspired by Italian history, classical history, the incredible artworks around him, the frescoes, the paintings. Really, the old masters got into his blood, and you see it here. And this 1961 period is one of the most successful moments where he really created this new visual language. And if you think about, I mean, Cy Twombly today even feels so groundbreaking and current and urgent, and this painting more than any other expresses that. It is so emotional and raw. He uses his fingers, he daubs paint with his palette brush and his hands. It is smeared, it is smudged, it is both violent and beautiful. It has such a harmonious coloration to it. It is so worked and full that it really has no comparable to come to market. We set the estimate at $40 to $60 million because the quality is extremely hard to find. Any work even close to this quality is in a museum, so it's quite remarkable. And the third work in the collection is a beautiful 1948 Cornell box of the Medici Princess. These works are Cornell's most important series. Of course, there's also a lovely Italian connection there with the Medicis. He often portrayed Medici prince and princess and the family. And this has sort of the playfulness of a game, like his slot machine works, and incorporates a very complex array of elements. So those three works make up the collection that Christie's is selling in May.
Those all sound so fantastic, and again, from such a formidable collection and collector. And it also ties into the different factors we discussed on what comprises an estimate, mm-hmm. and where provenance and quality, rarity, all of those components come in. Before we kind of close off today, are there any other highlights or any other announcements for clients to be aware of and collectors to think about as they go into the spring season?
Other highlights coming up from the auction, we're very much working on it. It's a busy time as we are gathering. The auction world never sleeps, but we are very, very excited to also be announcing the collection of Henry McNeil Jr. It is probably the best collection of minimalism in private hands, a formidable collector out of Philadelphia, who lived in really a church of minimalism. His home shows his unique eye and the way that he blended these seminal works of minimalism into a warm and livable environment. The juxtaposition between this very contemporary aesthetic and the mixture of materials, these metals, the plexiglass, the wood, the neon, mixed with this very classic Philadelphia townhouse, colonial style, is a combination that I've never seen. It's truly remarkable. The highlight of that collection is a Judd stack, estimated at $10 to $15 million, a mix of copper and red plexiglass. It's the most important and highest quality Judd stack to come to market from 1969, so very early, very, very exciting. And then there are top examples by Dan Flavin, other works by Donald Judd, Carl Andre, Saul LeWitt, Fred Sandbach, Richard Tuttle. The list goes on. So that will be a very exciting collection also to headline the spring sales.
Oh, so much to look forward to. And as you said, I know that there are many conversations still going on, as you said, as you're talking with clients and consigners. Emily, I want to thank you so much for being here, for having this conversation, giving us greater insights, not only into the mysterious world of estimates, but also for the upcoming spring season. And for anyone who is looking for more information, Christie's.com has all of the updated sale highlights, sale information, and the opening dates for the viewing, which will be coming this May. Thank you.
Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you.
As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG, member FINRA SIPC.